So this morning we're going on to look at Citta, which is the third main section of the Satipatthana Sutta. So the first section was being aware of the body, the second section being aware of Vedana, and now the third section being aware of Citta, which is translated in many, many different ways by many different people. I think the way I quite like it is the way Mahabodhi describes it as the shape of the mind, the broad shape of your consciousness. I quite like that. So it's more the sort of mood, it's more mood than specific mental events, which is more the domain of dhammas. But I'm just going to talk about it in quite a broad way this morning. I'm not going to go into the sort of Abhidharma analysis. That doesn't feel appropriate for this particular retreat, because this is an expansive, imaginative, evocative retreat. So I'm just going to talk quite a bit about love, actually, and emotion, and whether our mind is contracted or whether our mind is open. So continuing that theme that we've had running through the whole retreat of trying to make our practice very, very simple, and always checking in, am I tending towards a contracted state physically or emotionally, mentally, or am I tending towards an expansive state? And I think you really can't go wrong by making that your compass of your practice. Always try to create conditions where the mind can be soft. And also it means just noticing all the times that the mind isn't soft and the heart isn't soft, because of course we're human, we're going to be in contracted states often. I'm sure we all know that. So with mindfulness, with sati, which is one of the translations of mindfulness, there's this wonderful aspect to it, that sati itself is transformative. So if you're really in a rage, and then you notice, I'm really in a rage, you're no longer lost in the rage. So as soon as you bring awareness to any mental or emotional state, you're no longer lost in it. And the Buddha's saying that in itself is really transformative. And I really love that aspect of this way of practicing within the Satipatthana Sutta. So we're never taking a crowbar to our experience. I'm sure many of you all know what it's like to take a crowbar. You know, you sort of have a difficult state, you try and excavate it by force. It's never going to work, you're just going to create more contraction. But it's like the life of awareness itself, in the context of our broad going for refuge to the three jewels. You know, that's our compass, we're moving in the direction of the Buddha's teaching. And then we notice we're really holding against that. As soon as we bring awareness to that, there will be a shift. It's very beautiful, that, isn't it? It's like we don't really need to do anything more than be aware with kindness of whatever we're experiencing. So Sangharakshita says something very lovely to echo this simplicity approach, simple approach. He says, the essence of the Buddha's teaching is quite simple. Consciousness is not fixed, but subject to change. And if we can learn to trace the way it changes, we can direct that change towards positive growth. The essence of the Buddha's teaching is quite simple. Consciousness is not fixed, but subject to change. And if we can learn to trace the way it changes, we can direct that change towards positive growth. So that's this idea that we're living in this fluid, open universe, in the world outside and in the world inside, and that we can learn to direct that flow towards the direction that we want to go in with awareness. So this raises the question, well, what is growth and how do we grow? I think for myself, and I imagine this is quite common actually, when I first came across the Dharma, I knew that I didn't enjoy being the way I was, and that I wanted this freedom that the Buddha spoke of. So straight away there was a dislike of my present moment experience, and there was a longing for this idyllic experience that the Buddha spoke of. And I really thought I could just kind of ignore all the things I wasn't enjoying and forcibly move towards growth. And I did that for quite a long time. I'm a willful sort of character. And I'm idealistic. And I come from New Zealand. I was talking to Naga City about this yesterday. I've got this whole theory about how our psyche, is very conditioned by geography. So I come from a city that has earthquakes, and I come from a country that has very clear blue skies. So I never learned to trust the earth beneath my feet. And energetically, I was just going up and out of my body into the clear blue sky. And I didn't like my body, of course. My body wasn't my friend. It didn't work very well. And I couldn't trust the earth. So psychically, I was all up and out. And so, of course, the sort of blue sky of the mind and the golden light and enlightenment and bliss and freedom, all that was really attractive. But I was practicing with an escapist agenda. And I think this really isn't very uncommon. Maybe all of us do it when we first come along. It's the Dharma of escape. And we can really distort the teachings to suit that agenda. But unfortunately, eventually, we all have to come down to earth. And we either do that very gently over time, or we have some sort of spectacular Icarus kind of flaming descent, and we have a crash landing. I think that depends on character, that depends on psyche. I think probably I had a bit of a crash landing in my die landing. Just trying to think, was it gentle or was it kind of, it wasn't a massive...
A bit of a crash
for them. Sorry? It was quite a crash landing, wasn't it? Yeah. So, in a way, because of my character, I needed to be sort of broken. Some people, they just quite neatly soften, and some of us need to be a bit broken, this hard shell of defendedness needs to break open. And then I spent quite a period in the mid-90s in the underworld. It's really very interesting. It was like I went from being all up here to being, right down there. And I would say that period is one of the most creative periods of my whole life. And I was dealing with profound humiliation because, of course, my ascent, escapist, I'm going to gain enlightenment by will, had failed. So I felt I felt a failure as a spiritual practitioner. I felt, in a way, my will was broken, which was very, very good for me, because we can't live the spiritual life with will alone. We need to bring in the unseen. We need to listen to these deep, dark currents within us. And, of course, when your will is broken, to some extent your ego is broken, which is fantastic from a spiritual point of view. It's just very uncomfortable. So I did spend, a couple of years down there. I did loads of ritual. I lived at Taraloka. I'd go down the peat bog. I did tons of ritual. I made lots of katvangas, which are, like Padmasambhava holds a staff. And for me, that was a real symbol of uniting the heights and the depths. So the stars seemed to go right down to the middle of the earth and reach right up to the top of the heavens. So I did lots and lots of rituals with staffs. I made loads of bowls. That seemed very important, making lots of bowls. I did loads of shrines. So at one point, rather than having a shrine in my bedroom, I had a bed in my shrine room. Which is amazing. I think I had like 8 shrines in my room. And the bowl became the symbol of patience, of not knowing. So if I didn't, if there's something I didn't know the answer to, I'd write it on a bit of paper and I'd put it in the bowl. And the bowl was a cauldron, really. So my room just had all these cauldrons in it. And it really worked, actually. So it was a bit, rather than using logos, I was dropping down to mythos and not quite sure whether Eros was involved. Probably was, because there was a lot of passion. And it was living in a non-rational universe for a period of time. And as I say, it was one of the most significant times of my life. And partly why I really wanted to come on this retreat and do this retreat is I want to go back there. I've got a bit, you know, running a business and being a bit more functional. Like, I'm much more functional these days, but that comes with the dark side, even being functional. But what I mean by that is able to function in the world in a kind of high-functioning way. Then that becomes the refuge. And then it's really hard to get back down there. So I've come here to find my way back there to some extent. So this thing of what is growth, I think the main thing I really want to say is it's not a straight line. It's definitely a wave. It seems to be a wave motion. So you have periods where it's all quite sort of bright, light, maybe even blissful. And then at a certain point, something else will call your attention that's wanting to come into consciousness. And so you'll sort of go down and scoop up something that's unintegrated. And it will feel quite challenging and maybe even dark. And then that will be resolved. And then you'll have another period where it feels a bit more stable and balanced and bright. And then you'll scoop up another bit. But what's happening every time you do that, say the non-aware human being, your band of awareness might be about this wide. So what's conscious will be about this wide. Then there's all kinds of stuff sort of above and below. And every time you scoop up a height and every time you scoop up a depth, your band of awareness gets wider. So this is a nice model for what happens with the spiritual life. And eventually we end up with a band of awareness which is quite broad, and that means there's a lot that's known, there's a lot that's conscious, and that means we're not so derailed by our mental and emotional experience, because it's more, we get much, much more balanced and broad. I remember, it was maybe 30 years ago, a guy called Vajracitta, who used to live at Vajraloka, who's now died, went to the Langokan class, and he presented this model all these years ago, and I still think, oh, such a brilliant model. Very gradually your band of awareness is getting broader and you become more stable. And of course what we're moving towards is wholeness. I think that's really, really important. We're not moving towards just being this person who's operating in the sunshine. We become a person who's equally at home in the sunshine and the darkness, or the day and the night, or the heights and the depths. And then we can become whole. And all the myths, as Nagasiri's been saying, anyway, they're all about this. They almost always have some kind of underworld and some kind of brightness that we're learning to dwell in. So I think the really encouraging thing here is that if you have a period which is more turbulent, instead of, I think very often we can think, oh, I'm not doing it right. You know, I'm doing something wrong with my practice because I'm feeling stirred up. But with this model, it's like, yes, hooray, you know, there's another thing coming into awareness, another thing coming into consciousness, and I have the courage now to meet that. And then this too will pass, and we become more strong and stable. So it's not a straight line. And I think a really important part of practicing with our emotional life is listening, very, very deep listening to what is emerging. And that's hard, because so often we sort of shout at ourselves internally. So we're not listening, but there's this kind of hectoring that we can do towards our own experience. Or else we have expectations. What happened yesterday, we expect to happen today. Be that positive or negative, to use those terms. I don't really want to use those terms, actually. You know, be they pleasant or unpleasant. You know, we think, oh, it's going to happen again. Or, oh, I hope it happens again. You just don't know what's going to happen. You've never had this moment before. So very, very deep listening with an open mind, I think, is important. And then the wonder can start to emerge and surprise. So I don't know if I've said, but my mother died last June and my dad died in March this year. Gosh, I feel emotional. And that's a lot, isn't it? And my twin sister had cancer last year. So I've had probably, the most, you know, the biggest objective things of my life, in a way, happened over the last 12 months. And what I've noticed since my dad died in my meditation, if I listen, is it's all about going downwards. It's sinking, 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 sinking. And what I'm finding is that there's this cave in the middle of the earth, and there's a fire there, and there's women in red. They seem to be Tibetan nuns. I'm not at all sure why they're there or where they come from. It doesn't matter. And they're really looking after me. It's quite fascinating. So I sort of, but I have to fall. There's this thing of patiently trust your heaviness and fall. And there's a plummeting quality. And in that moment, I don't know where it's going to end. It's a plummeting quality, and then I seem to arrive in this cave with all these beautiful women. And I lie down, and they just kind of stroke me, caress me, hold me, hold my heart. Sometimes they lay out a bed of rose petals. Sometimes it's just blood everywhere, just blood pouring in this cave. And sometimes the walls of the cave dissolve away and I'm in the sky, which is completely wonderful and odd because it's in the middle of the earth, but there's the blue sky. And I think when I listen deeply, I then know, I see things, I notice connections. So for example, I came here to this place, this mandala, and I saw that Rupa guarding the fireplace, and I saw it. And for me, that's the most beautiful Rupa I've ever seen. And then I said to Nagasiddhi, said, yes, they were. What's the story of that Rupa? And he said, Mandaiva made it. Mandaiva, who lives here. And I thought, oh, how amazing. But that figure was in my cave. How can that be? A very feminine, that figure to me. So it's a he-she figure. I don't know what he is. It's a genderless figure, as all the Buddhas are. But and at first I thought, I wasn't sure if it was Amitabha. I thought it might be a nun. I thought it might be a Japanese figure. But that figure has been in my cave. So that's amazing. And that figure is guarding the chimney, which is the gateway between the worlds. So in a way, when I go down to my cave, I'm entering another world of some sort. And she's guarding. She's the guardian of the portal. So I'm noticing that because I'm more in touch. So mindfulness is the noticing. And then chitta, love, is the connection. But what I notice with this cave business is I have to let go of expecting to land in the cave. But as soon as I think, oh yeah, I'm falling, I'm going to go to the cave again, there's going to be the women, and then it's all died. You know, it's all become two-dimensional again, and like a story, like a fantasy. So there has to be this moment of complete not knowing when I'm plummeting, where I'm going to end up. And I think I just have to wait it out. You know, I really, every day I just tune in, wondering what's going to happen. Oh, this is falling again. I'm still going down, I'm still going down, I'm still going down. And I would imagine at some point I'll kind of bottom out and something else will happen. But I'm in a descent phase that will go on for as long as it goes on. And I'm sure it's a lot to do with grief and losing my parents and so on. But it's very beautiful and quite, isn't it amazing that there are these beings that want to love me and care for me, just waiting in the middle of the earth. And, you know, that's not classic Buddhism. There isn't a kind of story that I know of in the Buddhist texts of going into the cave of the earth and there's the Tibetan nuns who will caress you and cradle you and cuddle you. So it doesn't matter. You know, all the Buddhist stories, they've come from somebody's experience. So we will all have our own if we allow our imaginations to flourish. It's very important we don't inhibit it. Because if I thought, oh no, I'm falling, I've got to stop it, then none of this would happen. So if there's got to be that moving into anything can happen, I don't know, and then, oh, this is who's come today. So in the sutta, in the refrain, so as I was saying the other day, you've got these different objects of awareness, of body, vedana, citta and dhammas. And then between every single verse, you've got the refrain, which I said was like a drumbeat that's coming in and saying, and bring this kind of wise perspective to your experience. So for the, I'll just say for the mind, so one is aware of whether the mind is, whether you've got greed or an absence of greed. Again, there's no judgment. It's not like you shouldn't have greed. It's just, if there's greed there, no, there's greed there. And then bring awareness to that. And as soon as you bring awareness to that, it will subside a little bit. If there's hatred there or an absence of hatred, if there's delusion there or an absence of delusion, if there's a contracted mind or an absence of a contracted mind, a distracted mind or an absence of a distracted mind, a great mind, a vast mind or an absence of a vast mind, an unsurpassable mind or an absence of an unsurpassable mind, a liberated mind, or the essence of a liberated mind. I think there's one more that I can't remember. Let's just have a quick look. A concentrated mind or an absence of a concentrated mind. Yeah, so it's very simple. Awareness is the key thing. And so you do all that, and then you be aware of the mind, the citta, internally, externally, both internally and externally. You're aware of the arising and the passing, the arising and the passing of mental states of consciousness. You're aware of citta to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and continuous mindfulness, and you abide independent, not clinging to anything in the world. I mean, that's a lifetime's practice right there. You could just say that verse and you'd have your whole spiritual life. Yeah. But what I just want to talk a wee bit about the internally, externally aspect. Generally taken by the scholars to mean self and other. So this is bringing in the connected loving dimension into the whole Satipatthana Sutta. It's not just about self-awareness. It's about awareness of self and other and everything that we share. And you know, every one of us will have that, those tendencies of our consciousness, either towards contraction or distraction or greed or hatred or delusion or away from it. We're all doing that all the time. So we all look different and the details of our lives are different, but deep down we're very, very alike. So I think we can use our practice to shift away from focusing on difference to focus on what we share, commonality. And that's quite, that is very profound. Because often we go around the world feeling separate and different and strange and odd, and everyone else has got a really wonderful life. That can be the default setting of our projections. But we can shift to the sense that deep down I'm a human being, you're a human being, and we're in essence incredibly alike. There's a very lovely story about the Dalai Lama when he first came to the West, and he had a translator called Jeffrey Hopkins, who's an American Buddhist scholar. And Jeffrey Hopkins had been to teachings with the Dalai Lama in India that were really elaborate, great long philosophical teachings that go on for days, very sophisticated. And the Dalai Lama came to the West, and at all the interviews he had one thing to say. Nobody likes to suffer, we all want to be happy. And that was it. Every single interview at the airports, at the hotels, what have you got to say about, you know, Buddhism? Nobody wants to suffer, we all want to be happy. And Jeffrey Hopkins thought, God, what's wrong with the guy? You know, surely he can do better than that. Surely he can give a slightly more advanced teaching. And then when he really reflected on it, he thought that's what we need in the West, this reminder of our common humanity. And of course, that in itself is an incredibly deep teaching. You could reflect on that today. Nobody wants to suffer, we all want to be happy. Every single thing that we're all doing in our own individual ways is based on that essential drive where we're trying to avoid pain and to have happiness. But I find that very, very kind of interesting that that's what the Dalai Lama chose to say to Westerners, because we've lived this very individualized, atomized, separate. You know, we're not, compared with some more traditional societies, we're not very social. A lot of the social bonds are breaking down, and those social bonds are very, very important. So again, today, for the rest of the retreat, we're a community, we're a little society here together. And if you see someone doing something you think is strange, you think, well, that's just their version of, I don't like suffering and I want to be happy. And we're all breathing in the same way as we've been exploring. In terms of magic, the magic of seeing things and connections and serendipity, I went into the lounge today to sit and write the talk. There was an Othona magazine there. So in order to just distract myself for a few moments from settling down to writing my talk, I had a look at the Othona magazine. And there's an order member called Sahajatara. I don't know her at all, but she seems to be an extraordinarily creative woman. And she's a photographer. And she'd written down, the truth is that nothing is separate, and that somehow, beyond all the pain and the darkness, the real nature of all things is love. The truth is that nothing is separate, and that somehow, beyond all the pain and the darkness, the real nature of all things is love. I thought, oh, that's citta. That is having an open heart where we're resting in this, the natural state is love. And Amitabha, our mysterious figure at the other end of the shrine room, is embodiment of that. Amitabha is an embodiment of the true nature of the universe being love. So every time you look at Amitabha, you're seeing that truth in form. Yeah. So we're going to do some work this morning with body work and so on to try to bring out that sense of connectedness, that sense of love. Yeah. So I think, you know, we've had this theme of what's innate and what's acquired. And Agassiddhi was saying the other day that faith is innate, doubt is acquired. And I've been saying earlier on that relaxation is innate and tension is acquired. So I think love and connectedness are innate and separation and isolation are acquired. It's a nice way of looking at it. So we're putting all this effort into generating something that's incredibly painful and exhausting. But we can soften, soften, soften. And what we're softening into is deep interconnectedness, interpenetration and love. There's a Jewish historian called Yuval Noah Harari. He's written a book called Sapiens and another book called Homo Deus. And a lot of people are reading these books. Very, very interesting guy. And he says the two reasons why the human species have been so successful is because of our ability to cooperate in large numbers and because we can imagine. So love and imagination are the two reasons why human beings have survived, which I think is really interesting to reflect on as well, and of course very lovely for this retreat. So we can imagine shared dreamings. We often do that in quite a sort of unwise way, like money. We've got these discs down here that's just metal, but for each of us we have a shared imagining of what money means. And then we live in a universe that's driven by that shared imagining. Which is really fascinating, isn't it? It's actually just a bit of metal. And in fact, money these days, you don't even see most of it. It's just figures on a computer. And yet we're completely enthralled to this shared imagining. And the cooperation is very interesting, that in many ways it's unlikely that human beings have become the dominant species on the planet, because we're very, very vulnerable from a physical point of view. If you compare us to lions and tigers and elephants, we're tiny. We don't have big claws, we don't have fangs, we don't have big muscle mass. Our infants are incredibly vulnerable compared to other animals and mammals. If you look at a horse having a foal, you know, within minutes their foal is upright and walking about, whereas our infants take, I think it's about a year, isn't it, till babies walk. And yet we've emerged as a dominant species. And a lot of people think it's because we learn to cooperate. So in cave people times, The people who couldn't cooperate, they all died out. So the Lone Rangers died out. And those that learned to work in groups survived. So it's in our DNA to cooperate, because we're all the ancestors of those human beings, or those Neanderthals that learned to cooperate and work together. And we do that all the time. And it's very obvious in a retreat like this, we're doing tons of cooperation. We're washing up for each other, got cooks feeding us. We open doors for each other. And of course we can think, gosh, but human beings are so horrible to each other. How can it be innate to cooperate? But I think the desire to cooperate way outweighs the desire to destroy, because we could have destroyed ourselves so many times as a species, and yet we haven't, which is really worth reflecting on. We have the odd tyrant, but the great sea of humanity, generally speaking, is working towards goodwill, towards one another.
It's a healthy way.
Sorry?
It's a healthy way to look at it, actually, because one can be overwhelmed by
exactly.
the activity of everything, but to see it that way,
it's
really refreshing.
Yeah, and you can see that it's true, because we haven't killed, we haven't destroyed our species yet. And we've had so many opportunities to do so. So in that spirit of cooperation is innate, connectedness is innate, we're more alike than different. I really believe that. There's far more that we've got in common than that separates us. We're going to go outside and we're going to do a little bit of jiggling. And then we're going to come in and we're going to do something really interesting. I'm not going to tell you what it is. And then we'll have the rest of the morning around how can we allow our hearts to be awake, to know what's happening, and to continue sort of open and soften around our experience.